This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Anthony Swofford was a Marine Corps sniper who served in Operation Desert Storm. His gritty memoir, Jarhead, about his wartime experiences, was a bestseller and was later turned into a movie. Swofford's new memoir, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, is about dealing with his fame and success and about his longstanding conflicts with his difficult father, a Vietnam veteran. Anthony Swofford's adjustment to civilian life and his fame fueled a wild life of sex, drugs, and alcohol. He's as tough on himself in this book as he is on his father. They took a series of tense and angry road trips together trying to reconcile the hurts of the past. Anthony Swofford joins us on Radio Times from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. And Anthony Swofford, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. This is at times a very raw and at times a very angry book. Was it a tough book for you to write?
It was a very difficult book for me to write. One reason being that I was writing much of it while I was living it because I was taking these trips with my father and trying to make sense of our relationship and really trying to make sense of myself, figure out what being a man meant to me, and I was pushing 40 and had not yet become a father myself, and trying to figure out whether or not I had what it would take to be a father.
Well, and it's interesting to compare this book to Jarhead and the kind of, you know, inner battles you were having, not to be too psychological here, and obviously the battles of warfare.
Yeah, those battles lasted, and I think that they certainly lasted for my father, and my childhood was very much colored and somewhat contorted by my father's service in Vietnam. I was, in fact, conceived when my father was on R&R in Honolulu from the war. And he's a guy, he wasn't a crazy, messed-up vet or anything like that. Those cliches don't really apply. But he came back, and you come back from combat, and the world has changed. And he had difficulty adjusting and never sought help, and nor did I think he really ever seek the company of other veterans, which, in my opinion, has a lot of healing power.
Well, and do you think that that's a generational thing, comparing veterans today and veterans from that particular war, Vietnam?
Yeah, I guess there's an awesome cultural shift in terms of being able to say I need help, or the opening up of dialogue. That's very new. Although, my father at one point was ordered to go see the base psychiatrist, and he somehow dodged that appointment. And I remember as a kid him, I was probably a teenager when he told me the story, and he was kind of proud of having missed that appointment. And I thought, well, hey, Dad, if you'd made that appointment, things might have been a little bit different around the home.
Were you afraid of your father growing up?
I was. I was often in terror, in absolute horror, thinking about what the life was like when he would come home. We had two different homes, and there was one home that was full of light and laughter and goodness when my mom was home, and then when my father returned, things changed radically. We had to pretend like we were busy attending to chores, or we had to be quiet in order to keep Dad quiet and not to upset the balance. And that inconsistency, I think, was very difficult for me and my siblings. I was talking to my older sister about this book and about our childhood yesterday, and she had that same kind of experience of, which is confusing for a young child.
Would your mother protect you from your father, or would she in some way enforce his rules when he got home?
She, I think she, in order to placate him, protected us from him in terms of keeping the house in the order that he wanted. He ran us like a little platoon, and there were tasks essentially that had to always be done. And privately, I know that my parents, most of their strife was in fact about how to raise children, and her upbringing was radically different than my father's, and that was their marital strife was, in fact, about how do you raise a family.
Mm. He was a drinker, a womanizer, all these things you write about in this book.
Yeah, he was. His drinking wasn't—he wasn't really a drinker around the house, but he was one of those guys who went out with his buddies or when he traveled for work, he was definitely drinking and womanizing. And that was something that he made a really fatal error. When I was in my 20s, he decided that we would be buddies and pals, and he would begin to tell me about all of his conquests of women. And that was a really bad idea, and it really shattered any kind of trust that I may have had in him, because I realized that, in fact, he, in addition to being, you know, unfaithful to my mother and his marriage, I felt like he was unfaithful to the entire family and the construct of the family.
And sort of breaking those boundary, going over those boundary lines between parents and children?
Yeah, certainly. I didn't need to know those things. I had plenty of stories to share with friends, and I didn't need to know these stories from my father.
Indeed. I do want to have you do a reading, but just I'm curious about you joined the Marines. Was that in some way to honor your father, or to get respect from your father?
I think I did want his respect, but I also realized in hindsight that I was after this essential mystery of my father, which was combat service in Vietnam. It was something he rarely, if ever, talked about when I was a kid. And when a few of his friends might come over, they'd go out on the back deck and they'd talk, and it was a conversation that I was never allowed into. And so I knew that something mysterious had happened to my father at war. And when I was 17, I wanted to go find out what that mystery was and what it looked like and what it meant.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from your book. It begins on the bottom of page 2.
Yes. I believe that having been a Marine and having gone to war helped me become a great liar. Growing up with a Vietnam War veteran for a father helped me become a liar, too. I learned this from my father. If the lie will not get you blown up, the lie is worth whatever the cost. My father excelled at deceit. He deceived his wife and children about what kind of husband and father he was, but mostly he deceived himself about how that little war in Southeast Asia had changed him. Like many combat veterans I know, my father and I lived with the wickedly exciting and doggedly exhausting knowledge that we had once, for a short period of time, flirted with death and won. This knowledge is like a drug, the purest cocaine or 80-year-old Highland single malt scotch. Once you have had some, it alters your understanding of the world and of other people and of consequences. If I lied to a lover about what neighborhood or city or country I'd slept in the night before, it didn't really matter. The relationship might sour, but she would never kill me. Lying about sex became fun. It became a hobby. Manhattan bored me, drinking bored me, drugs bored me, but lying about sex never bored me. Eventually, I had wasted such a massive amount of money on women, wine, drugs, cars, and booze that my dissipation and deceit blew up in my face. I looked up one day and could no longer afford the mortgage on my apartment. I had to sell and became, in a way, homeless. I would have liked to ask my father for advice, but at the time, our relationship was in complete disrepair. But for some time, my father had owned a Winnebago and a dream that we two traverse the country and come to an understanding and discover a friendship. One trip wasn't enough. Neither was two. It took three.
And I do want to get to those trips that you took with your dad, Anthony Swofford, our guest today on Radio Times, reading from a section of his new memoir called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. Are you still a good liar?
No, I'm not. I practiced that in love affairs for a while, and I was not to make excuses, but I was in my 30s living in Manhattan, and I was mostly single ex-Marine, and I was kind of a product of a time and place, and I had some fun, and then I pulled my way out of it. I ended up on the side of a mountain in the Catskills, mm-hmm. alone, trying to figure out who I was and who I wanted to be forward. And the bulk of this book is, in fact, that journey. And some of that journey takes place in these RV trips with my father.
Yes.
But a lot of it takes place in my own head and trying to make sense of who I will be and what it means for me to be a man.
Well, and I do want to get to all that, but it is interesting and to talk to someone who's written a memoir who talks about lying. But lying is so powerful.
It is. It's an intoxicant. Yeah. That same kind of high that I think many. I tried to get that high from combat when I, you know, drove my BMW at 130 miles an hour, and I tried to get it with other kinds of excessive behavior. It's when you come back from that high of combat, that adrenaline high, everything else seems boring. You know, there's a great John Berryman line, life, friends, is boring, but we must not say so.
Mm.
And I think it's even more so for a combat veteran because the world has changed. The world hasn't really changed when you return, but you've changed. And so there's an essential thing that you're often after, that I know I was after, that my father was after. And that search was often wrapped up in fast cars and also in deceit.
Well, and not to spend the whole hour online, but you just say some very interesting things. You have a section here where you say, I know a bit about shame. My father built a roof of shame for his family to live under. Then you go on to say, this shame turned me into a treacherous little kid. I was sneaky. I was a liar. I trained my hearing so that whenever I heard my name anywhere in the house, I'd pick up on the fluctuations and intonations of the voices so that even if I couldn't hear all the words, I knew the intentions of the conversation.
Yeah, I was
very vigilant. I mean, kind of a vigilance as a kid, right?
I was vigilant. I had to listen. I had to know what was. I had to try to know what was going on. And this had to do with my father's inconsistency because, you know, one day he would be completely and overwhelmingly involved in my life in a tender way, say, you know, building a fort in the backyard. And my father was a builder, and he loved using tools and teaching me how to use tools. And my finest memories as a kid are, in fact, using tools with my father. He had respect for them and respect for building, and he taught me how to use my hands and how to build. But then the next day he might just wander off and not be involved at all. And so that listening and that wanting to know what was going on as a kid had to do with wanting my father to be consistent. And then, of course, you know, when you're a kid, if you lie, then that brings you attention.
Oh. Because it got you in trouble or what?
Yeah, because I always got caught, you know, so.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Anthony Swofford today on Radio Times. You may have read his best-selling memoir, Jarhead, about a decade ago, and it was turned into a movie of the same name. And he's written a new memoir. It's called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, and it's about dealing with the success of his book and that movie, also dealing with a very difficult father. They took several road trips together in an RV, which we'll talk about after this very short break. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Athena Health, offering physicians a dinner seminar on meaningful use and profitability, Thursday, June 14th at Le Méridien. Details at athenahealth.com/Philly.
Philadelphia Theater Company supports WHYY and welcomes Reasons to Be Pretty from playwright Neil LaBute, writer of In the Company of Men and The Shape of Things. A hopelessly romantic comedy about the hopelessness of romance. Reasons to Be Pretty looks at America's beauty obsession through the eyes of two young couples with razor-sharp wit and unexpected insight. Reasons to Be Pretty, May 25th through June 24th at the Suzanne Roberts Theater. Tickets 215-985-0420 or philadelphiatheatercompany.org.
On the next Fresh Air, screenwriter and director Lynn Shelton talks about her new film, Your Sister's Sister, starring Emily Blunt, Rosemary DeWitt, and Mark Duplass. She also directed the indie film Hump Day and the episode of Mad Men from season 4 in which Joan considers having an abortion. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY Bosch Thermotechnology, manufacturer of geothermal heat pumps that use the constant temperature of the earth to heat and cool homes. More information at boschgeo.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Anthony Swafford about his new memoir, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. It's about coming to terms with some of his inner demons, also his rage against his father. And they did take a series of road trips together to deal with some of the conflicts between them. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So whose idea was it to take a road trip?
It was my father's idea. The first trip, he asked me to drive from Northern California out to Billings for my niece's college graduation, and I thought he might just want a co-driver, but I wanted to make certain that he made it to the graduation. And my father has emphysema, so we jumped in his RV, and I don't know if you've ever driven an RV,
no.
But it's a very difficult and scary thing to do.
Because like they're so big and lumbery?
They're big and lumbery, and it feels like you're driving inside of an earthquake. But we were outside Wells, Nevada, and it was about 3 in the morning. I was pretty exhausted. I was driving, and my father reached out and grabbed my arm and said, "Hey, son, let's talk about some things. Let's clear the air," which was the understatement of the decade, that we needed to clear the air.
Well, he said to you on several of these trips, get the venom out. He clearly saw you had venom in you.
He did, yeah. Get the venom out was my father's phrase, and he repeated it. And it took me a while to get the venom out. I had a lot of venom. My older brother had died in '98, and my father didn't show up for the funeral, which was something I was unable to forgive him for. I thought it was a cowardly act that brought shame on the family. And but I have to give my father a lot of credit for asking me on that trip and for reaching out to me and being brave enough to ask me to be honest with him about how I felt about the past. Because I have a lot of male friends who have difficult fathers. And when I told them I was going on a Winnebago trip with my father, first they would look at me like I was crazy and say, "What on earth are you doing? You're going to be in a Winnebago with your pops for 1,000 miles?" And then when I returned from that trip, they were all kind of jealous and kind of wished that they might have that kind of time alone with their own fathers. And it didn't, that first trip, it didn't solve things. And it took a few more trips for us to I dig in and dig toward the truth. And at one point I realized that I'm trying to figure out why my father wants to drive around the country in this massive Winnebago and chew up all this gas. And I realized that for him it's kind of a time machine. And also I call it a truth machine. The two of us sitting in that room can come to some sort of understanding. And we don't totally agree on the past and the meaning of the past, but in the end, we come to agree on what the future can look like for us.
And you can't leave, obviously. It's just the two of you together in this Winnebago.
It is. I bailed out early on one trip. I was supposed to drive with him from Atlanta all the way back to California. And we were west of Houston, and I went for a run and thought I had a heart attack, in fact, on the side of the road, and got back to the hotel pool, and I was watching my father inside of his RV, and I realized that he had this fantasy of himself as sort of a Clint Eastwood character, an iconic Western wanderer who could live alone on the road, and I realized just how lonely and sad that probably was, and I was turning 40 very soon, and it really scared me. It shook me to my core, and I jumped on a plane home the next day. I didn't make it all the way to California. I kind of abandoned my father on the road there in Texas because I needed to get home and clean my own life up and try to move forward so that I wouldn't end up one day a lonely old guy in an RV.
Like your dad?
Just like my dad. I had all these problems with my father, and I didn't want to be I so badly did want to not be my father, but I had kind of become him. I was behaving like he was, being a cad and kind of wasting away alone, and I needed to change that.
You mentioned the fact that, your brother died of cancer. He was in his 30s, and this came up several times with your father, as you say, angry at him for not going to the funeral. His explanation is, you know, that it was too painful for him, and it was just his heart was so broken. It was so difficult for him to be there. As you look back on that explanation, does that humanize your dad at all? Does it make sense to you? Do you forgive him for not being there?
I finally was able to forgive him when my own daughter was, when he was introduced to my own daughter, who was just a few weeks old at the time. And when I saw my father holding my daughter, and I could see my brother's face and my daughter's face, and I knew that my father recognized Jeff and my daughter as well, I realized I couldn't judge him anymore. I couldn't judge him by that, about that. However, he decided to grieve his son's death. I finally understood that that was his business, and I didn't respect it, and I still didn't completely understand it. But I realized that that loss of a child was his loss, and it was his right to grieve however he did.
You describe, and this sounded like in many ways dramatic, tense, sometimes angry, a trip that you took with your dad. But at one point you even kind of fantasized about what it would, about killing him, frankly.
I did. I was, you know, my father enraged me. He enraged me because of my childhood and the verbal and sometimes physical abuse that he visited upon me and my siblings, and the terror sensations that course throughout our house. And I don't think that's so uncommon when you're angry with a parent, that you might have a father, that you might have patricidal fantasies. Mm. And along the side of the road in Montana, I did dip into one of those fantasies. It would have been an easy fix to all of my problems, to all of my psychological problems. And I was kind of tired of going to therapy and talking about my father every week. But thank goodness that these trips eventually did the healing.
Well, it sounds like you both loved your dad, maybe hated your dad, and as you also say, you loved to hate him. Just to complicate
things
further.
It was fuel for me for a few years, and he definitely added some fuel to the fire. One chapter in the book is about sort of a call and response, this 10-page handwritten letter that he'd sent to me. And he thought he was giving me some good fatherly advice, but it was a diatribe on all of my failures as a son. And that was a real, you know, he had attacked my character, and he cloaked that in fatherly advice. And I was still angry about that letter, and certainly angry about the way he'd behaved around my father's death. My brother's death.
Do you think your dad loves you, loved you?
Yeah, I think my dad definitely loved me, loved our family, loves me now. He's a complicated guy. He suffered, a month into his life, he suffered probably the worst wound, which is the death of his mother. She died when he was a month old, and I don't think my father ever got over that, and I don't know how anyone would, and that's something that's in the room with him all the time. And I think works hard. He's nearly 71 years old now. Mm-hmm. And that is still a very fresh wound for my father. I think he found it difficult to love and difficult to be comfortable and feel safe within a family, even though he had one. And I'm not sure that he knew what it meant to be a father, knew the consequences of his actions.
How's his health?
He's still quite ill. He's on oxygen, and he probably moves at about 20% of normal activity. I saw him last week in Northern California, and he's at a kind of plateau.
And has he read the book?
He hasn't. I'm going to send it to him next week.
Are you nervous about that?
I'm a little nervous about it, but I will, I'll send a preface, a handwritten preface explaining some things. And my father is a sophisticated guy, And I think if he pushes all the way through to the end of the book, he'll realize that the work that I was doing was about, in fact, reconciliation and moving forward. And as much as the past is, you know, never past and never dead, not allowing it to control me. And I'm a father now, and that's a shift. And I'm no longer just a son. I'm also a father. And I think I know that my father is likes to see me and witness me as a father. And I think that is, you know, the essential shift mm-hmm. in the book. And it's also an essential shift in our relationship.
And that's Anthony Swofford, our guest today on Radio Times. He's written a new memoir called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. And he's written other books, including Jarhead. And he joins us on Radio Times to talk about his relationship with his father and what happened, I guess, after he came back from the Gulf War. And he certainly engaged in some wild activities, to say the least, a wild ride of sex and drugs and alcohol. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You write in a great detail about all the women that you had sex with and some of the sort of alcohol or drug fueled wild activities. As you look back on that now, what was that about?
It was about not really knowing what the future would hold and not wanting to live responsibly and not wanting to commit to one woman and one kind of life. And I was also still after that combat high. It was a mm-hmm. post-combat kind of experience that allowed me to not really worry about consequences and take risks, because after making it through combat, the consequences of actions in the civilian world seem minor and unimportant.
And do you think also the success of Jarhead and the movie, I mean, that sort of fueled your behavior as well?
I don't know that that fueled my behavior, but it allowed me to have time on my hands and money to burn. And, it allowed me to live a certain lifestyle that I was living in New York City. If I'd been living in Topeka, Kansas, I would have behaved a little differently, probably.
Oh, I mean, New York City being full of quote unquote temptations.
Yeah, temptations, and it's an easy place to live multiple lives, and it's an easy place to deceive mm-hmm. people, and in the end, you know, deceive oneself.
But, I mean, it is interesting. You mentioned this earlier, some of the parallels between your father as a young man growing up. He had a family, but also what you were doing as well. Do you see some connection there?
Oh, I do, absolutely. I wanted so much to not be my father that I did, you know, what many men do, and I became him exactly. I suppose I was a womanizer. I lied to women about what I was doing with my life and what I wanted from them and what my plans were for my future, and that's something that my father did. Yeah. And but I did that. I wasn't married when these things happened, and what ends up happening to me is that I have sort of what I call a reverse midlife crisis, because I hit 40 and suddenly, you know, I've already crashed a sports car and I've done all of these crazy things, and I was about to turn 40 and I wanted a station wagon and a wife and a baby.
Settle down, right?
I wanted to settle down. I needed to settle down and get rid of that lifestyle.
And it sounds like when you saw your wife for the first time, it was, if not kismet, there was you wanted this life with her.
I did. I knew it right away. I dated a series of women who, you know, were doctors and lawyers and physicians mm-hmm. and bankers and the daughters of those people, and had a lot of fun running around New York City. And I had been on the phone with a friend the day before, and it was when I'd come back from that trip with my father, come back from Texas early, And I told this friend of mine, yeah, I need to meet a woman whose mother was a waitress at some point. Not for fun during college, but in order to make the rent. And I met the woman who had become my wife. And one of the first things she said to me was, you know, my mother was a waitress at the officers club on Camp Lejeune.
And you said, bingo,
and,
right?
Yeah, I thought, oh, wow, this is her. This is her. Don't mess this up, Tony. And I got rid of every dangling alliance that was in my life right away, you know, before I even saw her again, because I didn't want to. It's, you know, it's so easy to put things in the way of a good life, and I'd done that, and I didn't want to do it any longer.
But you do describe a moment as a cheater's twinge, meeting up with a woman and having that I guess momentary thought that you could do this and not get caught because you were good at it.
Yeah, I was wandering around New York City in the East Village, which was one of my haunts when I was behaving badly. And I knew that this particular woman was probably hanging out at this particular bar. And I wandered in, and my future wife was out with friends. And I knew exactly, you know, the protocol for being unfaithful and making up lies and making it happen in New York City. As I said, it's not a very difficult thing to do. And
yeah.
And the temptation was there, and I fantasized about it for a moment, and then I, you know, walked out and made it home to Brooklyn quickly to my future wife.
And do you see fatherhood as a much of a test of manhood as war can be?
I mean, much more of a test. That was probably part of my altered vision was in fact that I thought that high of combat was something to try to replicate, and that was also the truest and purest test of manhood. But I just don't feel that way anymore. I know that, and in fact, it was, you know, a true epiphany. My daughter was probably about 5 hours old, and my wife was sleeping in her hospital bed after having given birth, and Josephine was on my chest, and I realized that this was the real test. That no matter what else, you know, I'll continue to write books, I'll do many other things in my life, but the real test, the real thing that will matter, is what kind of father I will be to this little baby who's sleeping on my chest.
And we're almost up on a break here. Do you feel up to the task? It's not easy being a parent.
No, I know it's not easy, and you know, my daughter's 9 months old, and
right.
People look at me like, oh, okay, sure, buddy, talk to me in 5 years.
Or 15, yes.
Or 15. But I do feel up to the task. I'm very much aware of you know, what the task is, and I may overthink it, but I try every day to think about what kind of father I want to be, and to make sure to try to be successful and to look forward.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Anthony Swofford about his new memoir called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. He also wrote a very moving piece in the Daily Beast, which I do want to talk about after this very short break, about veterans and the high rate of suicide. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Culinary Arts Institute of Montgomery County Community College supports WHYY. Whether looking to launch a career as an executive chef or just looking to get a better handle in your home kitchen, the Culinary Arts Institute has classes to serve a full range of needs and interests. The school's certified faculty prepare students with a foundation in the classics while educating them on the latest modern trends. Details at mc3.edu/culinaryarts. The Culinary Arts Institute of Montgomery County Community College. Education at the knife's edge.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Harvard historian Jill Lepore has taken on nothing less than America's thinking on life and death, and she stars with Milton Bradley's Board Game. Also, Jess Walter's new novel, Beautiful Ruins, interweaves Hollywood hype and La Dolce Vita. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. At Fox Chase, molecular medicine helps improve diagnostics for cancer patients. Using the genetic analysis of tumor cells, doctors readily identify the best use of existing cancer drugs and design more effective clinical trials. As DNA sequencing becomes more prevalent in cancer care, Fox Chase is committed to discovering how these methods can best help patients and lead to better outcomes. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Anthony Swofford about his new memoir, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. Also want to talk about a piece he had in the Daily Beast about the epidemic of military suicides. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Anthony, in your book, you talk about visiting a Bethesda Naval Hospital. What were you doing there? What brought you to the hospital?
Well, I'm a big fan of an organization called Disabled American Veterans, and they're one of the oldest, if not the oldest, veteran service organization in the country that do advocacy and policy making only for injured veterans. So under their umbrella, I was invited to the Bethesda Naval Hospital, which treats injured Marines. And I was up on a floor where there were very recently injured Marines. So most of these, it was all male Marines who I visited this day. They were all injured within the prior week, sometimes a few days, maybe a few weeks, and in the early stages of their recovery from their wounds.
Yeah, and your description is very moving. It's frankly heartbreaking. You're talking about wounded vets and their families, and these are obviously, you know, relatively young people with pretty serious wounds and loss of limbs. You're a Marine yourself, but is it hard to have those kinds of conversations when one can see so clearly what's wrong and frankly what someone's young life might be about?
It used to be very difficult for me. That was probably in the early stages of spending time around these veterans. But the thing that, and I write this in the book, thing that blew me away then but doesn't any longer is the sort of can-do spirit and the looking forwardness of these young injured people. And they bring, miraculously, they bring some of that same spirit and discipline that one must to combat into these new lives. And that's not to say that there's not a lot of damage there. You know, the thing that on that trip to Bethesda that that really shook me was the fact that most of these guys had mothers who were in their late 40s or early 50s. And for the men who had suffered the worst injuries, these women were coming to the realization that they'd be probably spending the rest of their lives as caretakers for their very young sons. Yeah. And that was shocking and difficult to witness.
Let me ask you a bit about what you wrote in the Daily Beast about this epidemic of military suicides, which concerns, I think, everybody. About 18 suicides a day of these veterans, I guess, returning from war. Is that correct?
Well, 18 suicides in the veteran population in general. So that's veterans of any war or even peace. But some people cite numbers that claim that as many veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan have now taken their own lives as have died in those two wars in the last decade plus.
Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, a strange thing happened, and that is in the last decade, military service used to be a protective factor against suicide, so that men and women in the military killed themselves less often than their civilian counterparts. And that has completely disappeared and even reversed. So now you see that a male military serviceman age 18 to 34 is two times more likely to kill himself than his civilian counterpart. Mm-hmm. And in the female population, it's even higher. The rate is three times as likely for a successful suicide. And the only thing, no hard research has been done yet. So a hard researcher will not say, will point their finger to this, but a practitioner and practitioners in general and the men and women who are veterans in general will say that it was the multiple deployments that have really taken a toll on the psyche of these young men and women. And the multiple deployments increase the exposure to combat trauma and to combat stress, and that what used to be the protective factor, which was military service, is now gone.
And does that mean the VA is not doing its job, or that the problems are so intense and maybe even overwhelming, and that they're trying to keep up with what's going on psychologically with these veterans?
I think the VA, people at the VA care a lot. There are a lot of people who really care about this problem and are working hard to help veterans. More work can always be done, and I think it has to do with funding and also outreach. In reporting that piece for Newsweek, the thing that kept coming up with practitioners and advocates was the stigma against mental illness that's here in American society in general, but it's even more so, more intense in the military. So you have a young guy who's supposed to be tough, and he's supposed to go off and fight and protect, and then he comes home and he may be a little shattered, or he may be a little scared, or he may be out of balance. And as one person I spoke to said, there's a stigma against blisters in the military. So of course there's a stigma against mental health issues. So I think outreach is essential, and I think something has to happen earlier. It has to happen within the military. There has to be a hardcore cultural shift. And we have to let these young men and women know that if they think they are in trouble, that it's okay to reach out, that in fact it's a brave move to pick up a phone and to call and ask for help.
Did you recognize that in yourself, that you had to kind of suck it up after coming back from the Gulf War?
I did suck it up, and I was quiet, and I did something that I think a lot of veterans do, and that is I got out of the Marine Corps, and I decided, okay, that's over. I'm done with it. I'm not a Marine anymore. I'm going to become a student. I'm going to become a writer, and that part of my life is over. And but I was fooling myself, and then I wrote my first book, Jarhead, about being a Marine, and I could no longer avoid self-identifying as a veteran and as a former Marine and as a former combatant. And in fact, that then brought me into the company of other veterans. And so I can drop into a room of veterans, and I know their language and I know the codes, and I'm very comfortable there. And I realize, and this is only recently that I realize it, the last decade of my life when I have spent considerable time around veterans was actually a healing practice for me. It's good to be in a room with veterans. Mm. And one thing that a doctor named Jonathan Shea, who's out of Boston, he's written quite a bit about veterans and the return home and PTSD. And I asked him, I had a long conversation with him. He's a brilliant guy, brilliant theorist and practitioner. And I said, but okay, Dr. Shea, a woman calls you up and says, doctor, my son or my daughter, they're in really bad shape. They won't leave the house until 3 a.m. and they don't talk to anyone. Like, what does my kid need? And he said, it's very simple. They need sleep and they need peers. Hmm. And he said, I've never treated a veteran who was sleeping well, who was super haunted by his or her past. And I've never treated a veteran who could walk in weekly to a room of other veterans and share the past and talk about the future and not feel judged, because that room of veterans is a non-judgmental room. And for Dr. Shea, it was very simple. Sleep and peers can really heal.
That's fascinating and moving on many levels. And I'm thinking about that peer group. Does that always mean talking about combat, or is it just a kind of a recognition that you've been through this before? You have shared something, even if you weren't on the battlefield together.
Yeah, I don't. And I talked to a few guys who really were helped by peer to peer groups. And this was a 33-year veteran of the Marine Corps. He'd been in every conflict since 1973. And I asked him that. So do you guys just sit around and tell war stories?
Yeah.
And he said, no, not at all. We talk about golf. We talk about, you know, our broken down truck. We talk about politics. And certainly sometimes we share intense stories of combat. But it's a camaraderie that's shared that can somehow doesn't totally replicate the camaraderie and the esprit de corps of combat. But it is a safe place and a comfortable place and a place. You know, a lot of times, what I heard from a lot of veterans when I was reporting this piece was they came home and their friends back in, say, Missoula said, hey, how was combat? What happened? And then as soon as they started telling the true story, so this is what happened. This horrible thing happened. You know, I saw a child dead from an RPG. You know, I saw a mother holding her dead child. Like, no one wanted to hear that. And they were eventually looked around, and their civilian friends really didn't want to hang out with them anymore because they wanted to ask the salacious question, hey, did you kill anybody? But they didn't really want to know the answer, nor did they want to know the complicated effects of what happened over there.
I know you're not in the advice business, but if those are the things not to ask someone who's been to war, what is the right thing to ask or say or do? Or maybe it's, you know, just sitting in silence. I what do you suggest people do who do care about veterans, want to be helpful?
I think maybe, you know, just how are you doing? Like, you know, what's your life like today? I think the, you know, if a veteran does want to open up and talk about his or her past, that'll happen naturally. Mm-hmm. I don't think they want to be prodded. I always, you know, when I meet a vet, I had a cab driver yesterday in Portland, Oregon. He was a vet, and I just said, "Hey, how are things going today?"
Yeah.
You know, I knew he was injured. What's your injury like? What's your recovery like? How's the VA treating you? And you know, eventually, if a vet wants to, they'll get around to the particulars of their combat service and what it was like. But I think generally they want they want to be back in the world, and they want to be seen. People back in the world trying to make sense of their past and moving forward.
I've heard people say that the real 1% in this country are those people who have served.
Ah, I hadn't heard that yet, but they're a minority, certainly.
Right, but I wonder whether that disconnect between the, you know, people like you, a tiny portion of the population that have actually served, and then the rest of us who, you know, live our lives.
I think that has some bearing on how veterans feel as though they're being perceived or really not being perceived. You know, when a guy came back from the Vietnam War, whether or not someone was pro-war or against the war, it was on the tip of everyone's tongue. It greatly influenced the culture. And these men and women return now, and the culture really isn't influenced by what's going on. And we've, you know, been at combat in a couple different theaters for over a decade. But it is a small percentage of our population who've gone off and fought, and it doesn't seem to be something that really matters. I think that's something that I hear from a lot of veterans. Like, they come back and they feel forgotten right away.
Yeah, people don't know we're at war.
No, it's easy to forget that we're at war.
You talk about the importance of peer-to-peer conversations. Interestingly, you know, you're a veteran, your dad's a veteran. Have you and he ever talked about your war experiences? Has that brought you together at all?
It has brought us together. My life is much different than my father's, but one thing that we share is a war experience and a life that was marked and changed by military service. And that's something that we can always talk about and always share. And that was always a safe room for us to go to talk about our past and at combat and in the military.
One of the things he says to you, this is your father, is that he loved your mother. I mean, he was a womanizer. He loved your mother. Did you believe him?
I did. When he told me that, I did believe him, and I believed him because there was a recognition in his voice that that he had failed her, and that he had failed our family, and that if he had a chance to do it again, he would have done it differently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as an older man, he recognized the long cost of you know, that failure as a husband and as a father.
Your dad now, as you said, your daughter's about 9 months old, and I mean, we're all influenced so deeply sometimes in ways we don't understand by our parents. Do you see your father in yourself as a father yourself?
I don't yet, and you know, I hope that you know, the finest points of my father are the moments when he was patient and he would teach me how things worked and how to build mm-hmm. things, and I love working with my hands, and I hope that I'll be able to bring that to my daughter. I think for my father, fatherhood and what it means to be a father was kind of an afterthought. I think he was going through his life, and his life was primary and his needs were primary, and I'm going to be a very different father. I open this book with this quote by Shunryu Suzuki, yes. A good father is not a good father. And I try to think of that quote every day, and I try to think about what it means to be a good father, and I hope that I never wake up and think, oh, wow, I'm a good father. I think of it as a project and something that will change, me, and that I must adjust to, you know, whatever my daughter's needs are.
Well, Anthony Swofford, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for writing your book and for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. It's a memoir written by our guest, Anthony Swofford. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Our interns are Jared Brausch and Michaela Cross. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Bilder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.